Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderpool.
It's Thursday, April 25th. Take your sons and daughters to work day. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. Ag to go or ag to grow food.
Fanged and Dangerous, the living legacy of the first sky tiger.
And a pilot for voter-owned elections moves out.
Meanwhile, there's music in them thar hills.
Plus, a backyard quiz about an ook to boot. Grafting bills in today's reality check and the BBC World Report. Now the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Obama administration says it has concluded that chemical weapons have been used in Syria. The White House has said the use of such weapons would cross a red line and could lead to a U.S. response. But as NPR's Larry Abramson explains, for now, the administration says further investigation is needed to establish the facts.
The administration informed Congress it has physiological evidence that chemical weapons, specifically sarin nerve agent, has been used in Syria on a small scale. In a letter to lawmakers, the White House also says it believes the Assad regime is probably behind the use of such weapons. But the letter says the United Nations needs to investigate the matter more fully and does not call for a U.S. response. The United Nations has already been trying to get into Syria in order to investigate, but has been unable to get Syria's cooperation. An Israeli expert announced earlier this week that he believes Syria has used sarin against its citizens. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The Russian government's predicting Washington will now strengthen its security ties with Moscow as a result of the Boston bombings last week. Today, President Vladimir Putin said the West was wrong to support militants in Chechnya. The bombing suspects are Chechen. Also, Russia had raised a red flag about one of the alleged bombers, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was killed in a gun battle with police days after the bombings. The Lebanese militant group Hezbollah is denying reports that it sent a drone into Israeli airspace. The statement on Al Manar TV comes hours after Israel announced it had shot down a drone. Asked if he believed Hezbollah was behind it, an Israeli military spokesman said an investigation was underway. In the U.S., analysts say the latest drop in new claims for unemployment benefits in the U.S. suggests employers continue to hire. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports they fell by 16,000 last week.
Economists say after weaker numbers on home sales and orders for durable goods, they're encouraged by new claims dropping to a seasonally adjusted 339,000. The Labor Department says the broader four-week average also declined.
I think we're well on our way to a recovery, and I think it's just more of the same. That is, we're adding jobs at a moderate pace, but we're really not making up much of the ground that was lost during the downturn.
That's Chief Economist Scott Brown at Raymond James & Associates. He expects April's employment numbers due out next week to show continued modest job growth in the economy. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 88 points at 14,764. NASDAQ Composite Index up 29 or nearly 1% at 3,299. And the S&P 500 also up nearly 1% at 13 points at 1,592. This is NPR News. Five presidents made a rare joint appearance in Dallas today for the George W. Bush Presidential Center's dedication ceremony. Barack Obama joined Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and the honoree's father, George H.W. Bush, to pay tribute. Earlier, the younger Bush addressed efforts to implement sweeping immigration change through Congress. He said he was encouraged.
I hope it happens because it's the right thing to do. The problem with an issue like immigration is that there are a lot of moving parts. Yeah. And a single moving part can end up disturbing a lot of people, and sometimes people focus on the moving parts as opposed to the whole.
Speaking on CBS, Bush said he hoped some of his fellow Republicans were not getting on board immigration overhaul just to win the Hispanic vote. South Africa is mourning the death of the pilot best known for flying a jet over a stadium during the final of the 1995 Rugby World Cup, a moment that NPR's Fabia Quist-Arkton reminds us was memorialized in the movie Invictus.
Starring Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela, Invictus, the film, like the real-life rugby final, depicted the late South African pilot, Laurie Kay, flying a Boeing 747 passenger plane low over Ellis Park Stadium. South Africa's Springboks triumphed over New Zealand's All Blacks. The victory, the flyover, and Mandela's gesture pulling on a rugby jersey were a unifying moment in a South Africa emerging from racist white minority rule. Kay, the 68-year-old aviator who died from a suspected heart attack at Kruger National Park on Wednesday, had been flying helicopters on patrols against rhino poaching. Ofebia Quistockton, NPR News, Johannesburg.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, sponsor of the Zurich Classic Golf Tournament in New Orleans, April 25th through April 28th.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Can Hawaii increase its food security? That's been the big question for decades. Last month, a week-long HPR initiative considered how Hawaii will feed itself. On The Conversation, we've been following a pair of bills that could provide purchase power for Dole plantation lands and create a new food security department. The bills are now in conference. Each alone or both together will grow ag. But the real question is whether they will support food production or ag for export. Ashley Lukens of the Hawaii Food Policy Council is back with us this morning for an update. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, since the last time that we talked several weeks back, the bills have undergone, particularly 747, a lot of change and an increase of money to buy these bills. And it looks very good for ag. Does it look very good for you and me?
Good morning. I think that's a great question, and I think it's a question that when we consider 747 on its own, I can't answer definitively. The bill allows the state to issue $175 million in revenue bonds to purchase Dole Plantation. And so in some ways, it is an amazing opportunity to keep our agricultural lands in agriculture, but not necessarily for those of us that are interested in questions of food self-sufficiency and a healthy food system, not necessarily in food production. And so I think it raises some interesting questions as to how we can make sure that if the state, via the ADC, purchases Dole, they're able to encourage that land is used to provide local food for local people.
But there's a whole issue of money, $175 million in revenue bonds. Well, you know, it's going to get paid back, and that means that there has to be the issue of economics taken into consideration. When we talked to Jimmy Nakatani, the head of the ADC, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, his point was that we have to look at the economics of this and how this is going to be able to see us through. And that might argue that if someone can make more for putting in a crop that can be exported, then maybe that might be preferable to creating more food here, despite the philosophical argument.
Yeah, I think that if we are going to use a framework of valuation that sees sort of the use of a land determined by what makes the most money, you're absolutely right that unfortunately, the system is designed so that land will probably be used for export-oriented agriculture. And I think some fear even more the expansion of seed production on our prime agricultural lands. But I think that also points to an amazing opportunity for the state to create mechanisms and incentives so that food production becomes a more viable and profitable enterprise. And I think the state has demonstrated through some of the other bills in the legislature that it's thinking towards that.
It's pointing, frankly, back to the other bill that we were talking about, which is the 524.
Yeah, Senate Bill 524.
And how that is shaping policy. Yes, there's a little bit of money attached to it, but it's more about how do you create an entire sub-department within the Department of Ag that is only looking at food policy.
Yeah, I'm so excited about 524, and I think the bills make a lot of sense together. Because if you ask folks that are in farming and they say, well, we don't have farmers to farm that land, or we don't have labor, or we don't have infrastructure to make sure that the land is watered. I think 524 says, okay, well, let's equip with the Department of Agriculture with the capacity to focus on food so that it can develop the educational and pilot programs so that if we want Dole Plantation to turn into diversified food farming, the Department of Ag is able to facilitate that process.
That also looks like it might be best done regardless of what happens with 747, because we don't really have a policy about food production. We give it a lot of lip service. We talk about how great it would be if we can up the percentage of how much we can produce for ourselves. And granted, nobody has been talking about how do we create food security for ourselves 100%. We can't, and we accept that at least right now. But to be able to better it by 10%, going that next 10% or the next 20% to do something, that really seems not to be on the radar of most people when we talk about food security. Why?
I think that in terms of perceptions of possibility, whether or not we're able to be food self-sufficient and what are the steps to get there, I do think that more and more it is on folks' radar, but they understand that there are these huge structural questions about competing land use. And I think that's when we come back to 747 and say, this is a really great opportunity to keep land that is already zoned agriculture in agriculture. And then what are the mechanisms whereby even a small portion of that land is used for food production? I know that in some of the versions of the conference bill, they've suggested designating the land as important agricultural lands in perpetuity to really maintain the zoning status of that land. And I think that it also allows the infrastructure on that land to be improved so that when farmers do go on the land, they're able to farm successfully. I think the question, of course, is that if the financing that's attached to the purchase of the land requires that the land generate a significant amount of revenue right out the gate, the only way that the ADC or any state agency is going to be able to fulfill the obligations on that loan or on that bond is by choosing farmers who are able to make really, really high returns immediately. And I think for food farmers, the long-term cultivation of the soil is going to take more time. And so I'm hoping that we can build that into the financing.
But whether or not it stays agricultural land or not still goes back to the question of agricultural land for what? For ag business or food production? Profitability versus food production. That part is what's seemingly missing. And even if 524 passes the other bill, it would create policy in the whole department, the sub-department in the Department of Ag. We got to get really clear what it is we want to have happen and not just be able to support ag and say these things at a very general or sweeping level that most people will say, oh, we should be able to produce more food. We should. But really get down to it. What does that mean? And at least by having someone who is focusing on that in terms of a department, that might be a good first step that we haven't been able to pull off so far.
Yes, 524 should definitely pass regardless of 747. It's an amazing bill, and I applaud the legislature for getting it this far.
All right. Well, we don't know exactly what will happen today, if it'll be moved along or simply pushed on to another time when the conference committee will reconvene, as we've been seeing with many bills kind of pushing along and pushing along. But we'll be watching. Thanks, Ashley, for coming in.
Thank you.
Ashley Lukens is the vice president of the Hawaii Food Policy Council and a PhD candidate studying alternative food systems in the UH Department of Political Science. She's also a Sea Grant graduate trainee documenting the impact of shifting land use practices. She's been following these bills that could alter the balance of how Hawaii feeds itself, and the links to both are on the website.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Coming up, when tigers have wings and legislative frankenbills. First, your quiz.
In today's musical backyard, an enviable career that brought the sounds of the ukulele to a wide audience over 9 decades. Along the way, our Hawaii-born artists collaborated with some of the giants of American music, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, and Elvis Presley. The Duke of Uke, as he was known, was at one time the world's oldest performing musician, and his jazzy approach to the instrument continues to influence young artists. He started playing professionally at the age of 8, entertaining Hawaii-based troops who were about to be launched into the European theater during the first World War. He kept it up well into the 21st century, and it's his name we're looking for in today's quiz. We'll tell you the next half hour.
It's one of the little-known stories of the Second World War and one of the most intriguing. Claire Lee Chennault, a retired Army captain, working with the Chinese government on air defense in their conflict with the Japanese Empire. Chennault commanded the legendary American volunteer group, the Flying Tigers, in their conflict with the Chinese conflict with the Empire of Japan. His granddaughter, Nell Calloway, is in Hawaii to meet with Chinese exchange students who are learning about an exciting and little understood chapter of our recent history. And she's with us this morning. And Nell, I started right off by getting the conflict participants backwards, but I think a lot of people do. It's people really don't know who was whom in those years leading up to the Second World War in Asia.
Oh, that's correct. And I think really and truly there wasn't a lot of interest in America of what was going on in Asia at that time. And so it's always really kind of been known as the forgotten theater because so few people have. But the thing about it is it's no longer the forgotten theater. China and Asia is very much on our radar screen. And so what we can do to try to improve relations by using this story, I think, is very important.
Well, let's set the stage. The Japanese Empire had been in an expansionist mode for quite some time, and they invaded Manchuria when? Early 30s.
Yeah? 1931.
Mm-hmm. So China, which was in itself had its own internal divisions, right, was in the process of a civil war, is dealing with a very serious threat from the east.
Right. That is correct. And that really just put them at odds because it was between the Kuomintang and the Communists, and mm-hmm. they were trying to see which one was going to take control of the country. So they really kind of let the Japanese come in and take over some territory and didn't feel too threatened by them for a long time until they realized that, you're right, they had far-reaching plans.
And then China was essentially almost two nations weakened by those internal divisions, very ripe for invasion when the Japanese Empire was anything but divided, right?
Correct.
So into this confused setting steps your grandfather. In an unofficial, at least in terms of the American military, he did not have an official role at that time. He's retired.
He retired in 1937 and accepted an invitation by Chiang Kai-shek to come over and to survey the Air Corps. He had been very instrumental in early aviation with tactical pursuit and had started really studying fighter plane tactics. And so when they realized the Japanese Air Force was as strong as it was, they knew they needed help. They had sought help from the Italians. The Russians had helped them some, but they really needed somebody else to come over and do an accurate survey of what was actually going on. So they invited him to come over to China and to do that. And he was only going to originally be gone for 3 months and do that and come home. But as it turned out, when he arrived in China, he realized what was going on and the power of the Japanese. So he decided that he needed to stay and help aid in that war.
Well, he had already made his name as an innovator in aviation tactics, right? Just using the advantage of people on the ground as spotters for when bombers were coming, yeah?
Actually, that's really interesting because he started that theory here in Hawaii, mm-hmm. and he was stationed here between 1923 and 1926. And in 1924, the Oriental Exclusion Act upset Japan greatly. And so he felt even then, 16 years too early, unfortunately, the threat that Japan was to the United States and to Hawaii at that time.
You know, Pearl Harbor is often presented as this surprise out of the blue, and yet it had been boiling up for decades.
For a long time. Very susceptible. And he even started, what he would do is he would put some men on the water tower at Pearl Harbor mm-hmm. as lookouts, so to speak. And he did armed patrols around the islands at that time. And that's when he started realizing that for the fighter plane to have the advantage, they had to have this warning net. And mm-hmm. so he started developing that idea, and it was very critical during the war. Actually, it was probably what saved the Chinese and the Americans during that war, because he already, when he went in 1937, he started laying the groundwork for all of that. And without that, you know, we probably wouldn't have lasted but a few weeks, including the Tigers.
Really? Is that vulnerable? Yeah,
that vulnerable.
Well, China, I mean, when he assessed the situation in China, they're very short on materiel to fight back against bomber raids. But what they had was a lot of people.
Exactly.
Right? So they could set up these. And it was very sort of, it sounds to me like a very low-tech early warning network where you essentially just have people on the ground who tell other people on the ground well in advance of the bomber's arrival. Is that an accurate description?
That is very accurate. And, you know, it's really interesting because China, back in the late 1930s, a lot of people probably weren't even aware about airplanes. And to be able to teach them how to send signals down these mountains, the Himalayan mountains, and they used balls, they used radios that
really?
They could confiscate. They did every means they could because there weren't very many telephones available, of course, at that time.
Yeah.
But to teach them how to assess these bombers and to figure out which direction they were flying and about when they would be arriving there was really, like you said, it's pretty high tech for that time.
And he's going into rural areas where it's essentially, we're talking a true peasant culture.
Yeah, it was in the mountains of the Himalayas.
And which is tactically a pretty difficult area to have any kind of communication in anyway.
Yeah.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and he recruited American pilots as the years went on and the war approached for the AVG, the American Volunteer Group. And tell me how that worked.
Okay, well, about 1940, of course, Japan was still maintaining superiority in the air, and China was out of planes, basically, and they knew that they were going to need some aid. The United States, by that time, was fully aware that Japan was going to be eventually a threat to them. So he was able to come home and to convince President Roosevelt to allow some of the aviators from the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Army Air Corps to be hired by the Chinese government. Therefore, they've had been given the name mercenaries and, mm-hmm. and many other names. But they were hired, and they were promised salaries starting at $600 a month. And they were told...
Good money in those days.
Very good money. Basically, they were making about $75 a month.
These are some adventuresome young men. I'm afraid we've just run out of time, Nell.
Okay.
I would love to talk to you longer.
All right.
Nell Calloway is the granddaughter of General Claire Lee Chennault, commander of the American Volunteer Group flying Tigers during the Second World War. She's visiting Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor today until April 30th in support of the museum's project Past to Present, U.S. Sino-Bridge of Connection. And details are on our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travassa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travassa.com/Hana.
We've come to expect the government to track our overseas travel. We know police can subpoena phone records, and many of our fingerprints are on file. But now, our tweets are part of our identity and a significant factor in some criminal investigations. I'm Neil Conan. Twitter's reach plus an unauthorized biography of Superman. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
The program you're listening to is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio members, volunteers, and community partners. Special thanks to Andapasta, Kukua Market, and Religious Experience Sauces for their generous support of Challenge 2013. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 826. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. For years, you've heard about the legislative practice known as gut and replace, where the content from one measure is quietly replaced with language from other pieces of legislation. But now we've witnessed the birth of the Franken Bill. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Mwahaha. Good morning.
It's alive. It's alive.
Well, you know, Franken Bill. We start to say that a lot when things that we thought were dead suddenly become resurrected and inserted very quietly into other bills. And the question is, where did that come from? And we realize exactly where it came from, a bill that died long, long ago.
Yeah, now in this case, what you have is a bill that died in one chamber, and then in the other chamber, they revive it, and then they actually put it into a new, an existing bill. They're not gutting and replacing, in other words. They're combining and creating this this hybrid, if you will, a living new bill with at least two separate topics. I can tell you that good government groups think it's not a good idea. So Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, a number of organizations submitted a petition
over the weekend,
just this week to the House and said, hey, look, this is really a bad procedure. Their big complaint is that it prevents the public from having the opportunity to weigh in on this legislation, because it's done after the bill's already been heard, and as you know, it's already conference committee, and that means this week, you know, you can't talk to lawmakers very easily about what's going into legislation.
I mean, we talked about one of those bills a couple of weeks ago as this was occurring with 252, with that bill that has language on geothermal permitting added to a bill about Native Hawaiian Roll Commission. Now, what were these two things doing together? So as these bills are stitched together simply for, you know, convenience of getting something done, it doesn't give anybody, as you say, the ability to weigh in or to comment. And in some cases, they have no relationship between the two things, which, you know, at least according to Henry Curtis, put it at odds with the Hawaii State Constitution.
That is correct. And that bill that you mentioned, HB 252, is alive, as are a total of 18 bills. About half of them are gut and replace. The other half are Franken bills or Frankenstein bills. I couldn't get a comment from the House leadership, but Donna Kim on the Senate side did say, look, we've received the petition. We'll be discussing how we can refine our rules and policies over the concerns that have been raised. But, you know, time is running out. It may not have any impact this session. It ends next Thursday. These bills are alive and well and moving to a deadline tomorrow. So we'll see if perhaps it might impact next session, but maybe too late for this session.
Well, given the fact that you've just laid out that timeline and there's no real discussion, we're going to talk about it now or we're going to talk about it next Friday or whenever it is, it looks like it's going to be well after the session that perhaps this has taken over, and we'll see if it affects us next session. But at least for this one, it looks like Frankenstein is rising from the table. Thanks,
it
Chad.
It walks among us.
Clearly.
You're welcome, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Talk to you tomorrow, Chad. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up, a bad case of the bluegrass, even money in elections, and for today's international news, the BBC World Report.
BBC News with Ian Purden. The White House says it has evidence that chemical weapons have been used by government forces in Syria. The Obama administration said the US intelligence community assessed, with what it called some degree of varying confidence, that sarin gas had been used on a small scale. It said, however, that intelligence assessments alone weren't enough to change America's position on Syria and that a full UN investigation was needed. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, says the surviving Boston bombing suspect, Jokhar Tsarnaev, told intelligence officials that he and his brother had intended to carry out a further attack in New York City. Mr. Bloomberg said the Tsarnaev brothers planned to detonate their remaining bombs in Times Square. Unemployment in Spain has hit a record high. More than 6 million people are now without work. That's 27% of the available workforce. Opponents of the government say the crisis has been made worse by tough austerity measures. The software giant Google has offered to change the way it displays the results of internet searches in Europe. This is to settle claims that it's abused its dominant market position. A new bill to remove discrimination against women in the royal line of succession has become law in Britain. It means that if the firstborn child of Prince William and his wife Catherine is a girl, she will be next in line to the throne, even if she then has brothers. The authorities in Iran have banned police from dressing male convicted criminals as women and parading them through the streets as punishment. Astronomers have discovered for the first time that starbursts, the birth of hundreds of millions of stars, have an impact far beyond their host galaxy. They say the starbursts drive a powerful wind, which can be felt up to 650,000 light years away, which is much further than previously thought. BBC News.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and you'll be some folks talking about what it's like to work in healthcare in Hawaii.
Well, and what it's like for the rest of us who are clearly going to be affected by a physician shortage that we've known about for years and years and years. Only now, with a new study from JABSM, it looks like it's going to get a lot worse. So, really, how do we find appropriate healthcare? And we've got Obamacare coming in, all kinds of things. Where does it go from here?
And one of the reasons it's getting a lot worse is that it's just not an ideal profession to be in anymore, right?
Well, it's tough for a lot of people. And you think about the fact that the average age of a doc in Hawaii is the middle 50s. And there aren't a lot of docs that have been attracted, even with loan forgiveness programs and grants and other things that might make it easy for them to, or easier for them to deal with the financial part of it. They're just not coming. And so what happens to the rest of us who need health care here? Who's going to be there to help us? Will it be nurse practitioners who will have expanded roles to play? How will we get the care we need in the coming years?
There is a shift in those roles, right, in what nurse practitioners are their assigned task versus those that are assigned to doctors, that kind of thing?
Well, there could be, and there's been legislation afoot for a while. So far, it really hasn't gone any place to be able to build out what capacity we have in healthcare and the provider side of it. And, you know, everybody's got their little place where they want to hang on to, their little fiefdom. I'm not sure they want to share some of that authority, perhaps, or that it's something that people would be comfortable with. But clearly, we got to do something because our population's growing, and unfortunately, so is this shortage.
It sounds as if it's a situation that's kind of reaching critical mass, that it really can't, that something has to give. Yeah?
Well, we kind of thought that, you know, quite a while ago. We've been talking about this on Town Square for, well, the 13 years plus that it's been on the air. And it's always the question of that's a pretty basic thing for all of us. How do you find the right health care? Who's going to be able to actually help you when you need it?
Well, it's an opportunity for people to call in and ask some direct questions as well, yeah?
Yep, we're going to have a full panel tonight. We've got George Green, the CEO and president of the Hawaii Association, the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, Dr. Nadine Tensale, who's from the Physicians Association, the Independent Physicians Association, and Joan Kraft, who is head of the Nurses Union. They have a lot to say about this survey, and we'll talk about it tonight at 5.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Beth Ann.
In live radio, as with most of life, timing really is everything. You may remember that last week on Town Square, we were scheduled to talk about the latest incarnation of the Fair Elections Bill. Only it went into conference committee late Thursday afternoon. On Monday, the conference committee reconvened with HB 1481 on the agenda, as it will later this afternoon. One of its proponents, Representative Della Al-Bolotti, is on the phone with us now. Good morning, and thanks for taking some time for us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Beth, and thank you for all your listeners for tuning in and supporting public radio.
We've been following this bill for a while. Clearly, there's been a movement toward fair elections for a while. We've had the experiment on the Big Island. Is now really the time that we're going to see this open up and break through the barrier that we've been pushing against for a while?
I think so. You know, with the new House leadership, with new folks in the Senate, there's a lot more commitment to, I think, relooking at the partial public financing system so that we've got kind of the stars aligned.
There's also been some pushback with Citizens United and the fact that, you know, people have said if you want to be able to combat this in a meaningful way, in the most immediate way possible, then you need to have fair elections. Would that be a fair statement?
That is an absolutely fair statement. Citizens United has made it even more urgent for us to take a look at this, and I believe Hawaii is one of those states leading the way. This is a direct response in many ways to Citizens United. This is a way to amplify voters' voices, the small donor voices within districts. So this is absolutely a response to Citizens United.
And while we're talking money, some of the concern from the Campaign Spending Commission was that, you know, we really didn't know how much money this bill was going to cost us. But even looking at some of the projections that we saw through voter-owned, there was, if you had two people from every district, it was going to cost no more than $3 million to be able to see this through for House candidates. And we've only seen a couple of people actually use this in past. Should we be able to look at this budget as being maybe a million or a million and a half?
You know, that would be ideal. The way the bill is structured now at this point in time, it is for elections in 2016. So we can always, appropriate some money either now or later. I think it's really important to get just the law on the books. And you're right, Beth. You know, in our experience with other partial publicly financed races, not everyone takes advantage of the system. So what we're not going to look at two candidates per 51 House districts. We're going to be looking at a much smaller number.
I mean, not only did not many use, we're talking, what, two?
Yes, just a handful on the Big Island pilot project. So, you know, there's a lot that a candidate needs to do to become qualified, and that's purposely built into the system because we want viable candidates.
So looking at some of that viability, I mean, first they're going to have to come up with their own seed money, use that until they qualify. If they qualify, then that seed money would be deducted from what they would get from public financing. But to qualify, they're going to have a lot of people give them $5 contributions, what, 250 people?
Yes, and what's key about that is that it has to be small donors from within the district. So it means that publicly financed candidates are truly, truly grassroots candidates who are knocking on doors, meeting their candidates, because they have to get not just $5 from each from registered voters in their district, but also a signature saying, hey, I want to support this candidate as a publicly funded candidate.
So this thing does... I mean, this measure would do two things. Ideally, get a candidate who might be intimidated by the amount of money he or she would have to spend to run a campaign. Also, trying to activate people in districts and get them to realize that they can be active in a civic fashion in ways that don't necessarily have to scare them either.
Yes, and I think that's the beauty of fair elections. It's about bringing the voter, making the voter at the center of the campaign. You know, it's very easy as privately financed campaigns to be chasing the big dollar donations, and that's the way the system is geared now. So I think this presents an alternative. It's an option for folks, and it doesn't mean that the privately financed candidates can't also do this, you know, but it does certainly, I think, tip the field in a way that is very exciting, innovative, and again, a counter to the huge amounts of money that we have seen flowing into our elections process.
Other states have already been through this, and we've talked to some of them from Arizona and Maine. How much does our journey mirror theirs?
You know, we're learning a lot from those jurisdictions, but we also can draw upon our own experience. I mean, our partial public financing system comes from our 1978 Constitutional Convention. But we are certainly informed. We're watching closely what New York is doing. Again, Arizona is another a leader in this. And we want to get the logistics of our program just right so that, one, it meets constitutional challenges, which could be expected, and also that is something that is viable and actually works at helping us elect candidates.
Is there anything in the current bill that you see as being a barrier? I mean, you mentioned possible constitutional challenges.
You know, the constitutional challenges I mentioned are just those largely leveled by the folks who brought Citizens United. You know, I think that we might see, as the bill is drafted, I think we're actually being very careful that it complies with free amendment, First Amendment rights. So I don't think there will be any real challenges. Again, we've learned from the experiences of other jurisdictions, but you never can tell. This is something that is, I think, very potentially challenging to the status quo.
So it's on the agenda for this afternoon. It was on the agenda for Monday afternoon, last Monday, also a week ago. How much more conversation do you think you need to have on this bill?
You know, it's about getting the details just right, and conference is a very interesting time here at the state legislature. So, you know, we want to be diligent and detail-oriented about the work that we put out. And so conferencing, I think, could likely very well go up to the very end. It is a bill that has a what we call a finance or WHAM hearing referral. So, you know, because it involves money, this is one of those bills that are always in play until the very end of the discussion.
Even though the money for this one is, as the budget goes, pretty negligible.
You know, it is a very worthwhile investment, I believe, in our larger democratic process. But money is something that is still very tight, you know, and we have to be careful about how we prioritize. So, again, you know, I am concerned that we have some appropriations. But on the other hand, it's also very important just to get the law on the books, the logistics, so that, you know, we can give time to the Campaign Spending Commission to look at what they need to do to gear up. And then if we need to, we can make the appropriations at a later time.
So really, it would be okay with you if the bill passed without any specific amount of money attached to it?
I always would like to have money attached to bills that I'm supporting. But in this particular case, I think this is something that could move forward.
All right. Well, as it's moving forward, it may not necessarily wrap up today, but we'll keep watching its journey. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me.
Dulla Albalati represents District 24, that's Makiki Tu Manoa, in the Hawaii State House of Representatives. She's a graduate of Princeton University and the UH Law School with a certificate from the Environmental Law Program. She practices in the law office of Eric Seitz and is a former state campaign spending commissioner, currently serving in the House Judiciary Committee. The link to the Fair Elections Bill is on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you about a Hawaii musical legend, the Duke of Uke, the man, and he really was the man, who popularized Hawaii's signature instrument. He performed with Elvis, Bing, and Satchmo, among many others, in a career that spanned a period from before the First World War to the second decade of this century. He was a jazzer, and he could coax an amazing array of sounds from his Little Flea. Those sounds went mostly unrecorded until 2004, when he put out his first CD at the age of 94, encouraging news of the It's Never Too Late variety. Ukulele virtuoso and one of Hawaii's most beloved musicians, Bill Tapia, lived to be 103. And that's the quiz from our backyard today. If you have one, you can send it to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Sabrina from Portland, Oregon. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Bluegrass music has always kept its back porch spirit alive, and that's really where the music belongs, in an informal setting. This is music created by people far from the concert hall, the high, lonesome sound of songs and harmonies imported to rural America from the British Isles, played on acoustic instruments. Thanks in part to its great patriarch, Bill Monroe, the music of the hills and hollers is now world music. And this weekend's latest edition of Bluegrass in Nuku'alofa's is expecting a record turnout. It's an event unlike any other, and Bluegrass Hawaii's Andy Char is here to tell us about it. Good morning, Andy.
Morning, Chris. Nice to see you.
You know, I'm trying to think of any other style of music where the musicians would assemble in quite the same way as you folks are doing this weekend.
Well, obviously there's one tradition that's not that far from where we are, the kind of Hawaiian kind of kapila.
True, yeah.
Very informal.
This is a bluegrass Kani Kapila. Bring your axe and whatever skill level you've got, whatever songs you know, and let's see what we can do, right?
Guitar, ukulele, banjo, mandolin, whatever. Exactly.
And you could also learn from, you know, I mean, it's about kind of stealing licks, right? And
that's right. This Saturday at our event, we're going to be, actually Saturday and Sunday, we're going to be running workshops. This session's offering is going to be particularly rich. We're going to have a workshop for advanced guitar players concentrating on fiddle tunes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a workshop for beginner guitar players concentrating on sort of rhythm guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our slow jam, which provides for, you know, playing bluegrass music, and we encourage people to get out there and take licks, but done at a slow pace so that people feel comfortable in stepping out.
At a learnable slow
speed.
Pace. Yeah.
We're also having a workshop on fiddle that's going to be run by Leslie Klein of the Saloon Pilots.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Yeah. And we'll have a mandolin workshop. We'll have an auto harp workshop. There'll be a lot of stuff for people that are interested in picking up licks, as you say.
Well, you know, with that very goal in mind, I went to a thing last year, and there were people standing in a circle on a rainy afternoon, and everybody kind of knew the protocol of the music. They knew the tunes, and these were people who were mostly strangers to one another. I kind of joined the circle, and I was struck by the fact that everybody knew what to do.
Yeah, there are certain protocols, although it's really easy to pick up. You kind of listen. You listen for the chord changes.
Yeah.
And people will, because the key of the song can change depending on the vocal range of the singer.
Right.
The person that sings the song is basically the guy that takes the lead, and he may call out. And instead of calling out G, C, or D, he'll call out 1, 4, and 5, which, you know, refers to the so-called Nashville system.
The intervals, yeah.
Yeah, and people understand that and just fall in line.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, in a way, what you're doing is you're taking music and sort of finding what's the universal language so that it can be shared with the most people in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, it's got that sort of ethos of big tent and bringing people in and that sort of thing. So it's a fun thing.
I think one of the charms of bluegrass was that I don't think it was ever designed to be presented in the Philharmonic Hall, you know. It was designed to be, it's party music. I mean,
That's true, although, you know, I mean, any sort of music is going to break down barriers if it's a good, vital kind of music.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are performances of bluegrass music. I saw on YouTube, Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder are playing with the Boston Pops Orchestra, and that was great.
And that's not a stretch at all,
no.
Because Ricky Skaggs is an unbelievable musician,
yeah.
But as so many bluegrass musicians. I mean, it's a real, you know, on one level, it's really a virtuoso music.
That's exactly right. The fun thing about bluegrass is, you know, and kind of in keeping with the big tent, is that in its basics, it's easy enough for any beginner to play along with, and then at the top end, I mean, it really requires a certain level of virtuosity to sort of keep along with
Somebody like an Earl Scruggs, a banjo player, is an unbelievable musician by any standard.
Yeah.
Doc Watson, yeah. Any guitarist, I mean, idolizes Doc Watson, I would hope. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
He represents perfection in a sense.
Yeah, that's true. But I think the other good thing about bluegrass that's going on is that there are so many young kids that are coming up through the ranks. And Sierra Hull, a fantastic mandolin who must be in her 20s, did work at Berklee School of Music and is getting the background in bluegrass there. But then, you know, the jazz influence from Berklee.
And that's the transition it's going through. It's well beyond the hills of West Virginia now.
That's absolutely right.
I think they've got bluegrass bands in, you know, South America and Europe now. It's crazy. Talking about how you were calling out chord changes and just sort of picking up something on the fly, we're going to play just a little excerpt. I brought my Git Fiddle along, and you gave me a brief introduction to the song, so we'll just hope for the best here.
Let me see.
Andy's playing his mandolin, and I'm playing an acoustic, what they call a dreadnought acoustic. And so, Soldier's Joy, right?
Right, you're going to call it out?
One, two, three, four. That's what I call an excerpt, Andy. But
A sample, so to speak.
But that, the mandolin, I think, really came into its own in bluegrass music, didn't it?
That's right. Of course, the father of bluegrass music, Bill Monroe, was a mandolin player.
Yeah.
And I think the people forget, well, maybe they don't, how important the mandolin is in the whole bluegrass band makeup.
It's very much a signature sound, and it's essentially a violin on a body that you pick with frets, right? It's the same strings, same pitch as a violin.
That's exactly right. Unlike a violin, a mandolin has 8 strings, but they're tuned in courses or pairs of mm-hmm. identical sounds. So,
you always, with strings that are paired, as with a 12-string guitar, you can never get 2 strings at exactly the same pitch, right?
That's right.
So there's always that little sort of wiggle between 2 strings that are matched up. It gives it a shimmer.
Yeah, that's right. And it gives it a fullness of tone that you wouldn't get if you only had 4 strings. Local musicians know there are 6-string ukuleles, there are 8-string ukuleles, and when you hear them play, it's a very distinctive kind of full sound that you can get with the 4 string.
And yet it's part of the magic of that sound derives from the pitch being just a fraction off, right?
Yeah.
So it kind of spreads around a little bit.
That's right. Kind of like, I guess, like an accordion.
Yeah, that's right.
Reeds and that sort of thing.
And then bagpipes, well, don't even get me started on those. But, you know, so much of the music is English and British in origin, right? I mean, old English music, and it really sounds like the melodies of bluegrass.
That's right. It's the Scotch tunes, excuse me, it's Celtic tunes brought over from, you know, the British Isles.
And they're actual reels and two-steps
and that
kind of thing. So.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes it really seems as if the music came over from the British Isles almost undiluted. I mean, when you hear some really old country bluegrass, it just sounds as if it had no outside influences at all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, bluegrass really comes out of the sort of old-timey tradition that existed up in Appalachia prior to the 1940s and all that. And then sort of in the early 40s, 1940s, bluegrass started to emerge out of that tradition. But bluegrass was really meant as sort of, while it was coming out of folk roots, really emerged as sort of a performance type thing
mm-hmm.
That stressed speed, stressed sort of aggressive instrumental playing.
Really flashy mandolin, banjo solos,
Exactly.
And, of course, Bill Monroe had both Flat and Scruggs in his band, so they're really sort of the founding fathers of that kind of instrumental style.
Right, and I think the vocal styles of bluegrass probably was part of that sort of performance ethos. People talk about this high lonesome sound of bluegrass, this is pure speculation on my part, but I sometimes wonder whether, you know, those high tenor harmonies that are used in bluegrass were designed to sort of throw your voice out So that
it does sound that way, yeah. Sort of you're at the high end, about to bust.
That's right, and just throw that voice out over a lot of noise in performance venues.
Well, a chance to try it out this weekend, Andy, and thanks very much for coming and joining us.
Thank you.
Andy Chars with Bluegrass Hawaii, which is organizing this weekend's Bluegrass in the Ko'olau's event at Ho'omalohia Botanical Garden. It's free, runs all weekend, and you can learn more from our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering private banking, trust administration, and financial management services to help individuals and families reach their financial goals. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com. Today on With Good Reason. 20 years ago, fly fishing experienced a renaissance when the film A River Runs Through It was released. Stan Ulansky, author of The Science of Fly Fishing, says an understanding of science can enhance an angler's experience. That's this evening at 6:30 on With Good Reason.
As the legislative session wraps up, there's a lot of there's an awful lot going on this week, isn't there? A number of your conversations referred to that.
And the fact that, you know, they don't wrap up just because they're going to be heard on a particular day or discussed on a particular day, that they're very often moved into another agenda a few days hence and a few days after that. And probably a good thing, though, that the legislature was able to come to agreement about the budget so they'd have more time to discuss some of these particular bills and then take it off for a vote. But still, it's going to be to the very end, as Del Albalati said, until we really know what's going to get funded and what isn't.
And this is the time of the session in which legislative monitoring becomes especially tricky, because now we're in conference committee. We're not doing public hearings, and public access is, in a way, curtailed a bit. Yeah? It's now in their hands.
Well, it's in their hands. You don't know what discussion is happening sort of in quiet corners, as happens all the time. But that's really been the whole thing, particularly when we're talking about those Franken bills and when they have changed and public comment on them is now long over.
So surprises could be in store.
Aren't they always? All right. Well, we're not going to have any surprises for you for the show for today because it's over. But wait. On tomorrow's show, it's Peter Sagal.
Plus, reverse karaoke with a virtual David Bowie and a live band. And the Big Island's best young jazz musicians take the spotlight.
I want to see that virtual David Bowie. If you've got something to tell us, you can talk back to your radio on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at Because HPR, or send an email to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you don't want to miss any part of the show or just want to listen on your own time, you can sign up for the podcast on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Meet us back here in the morning for more of The Conversation.